Hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon, and it's time for a podcast. This is going to be a good one. This is with the amazing Dr. Sandra Kaufman, who is the author of The Kaufman Protocol, right here. Two versions. Here you go. This is version one. I have version two on my bedside table. I'm diving deep into longevity and all the principles of why we age and how we age. Welcome, Sandra, to the podcast.
Oh, it is great to be here. I think we did this a little while back and it was so much fun. I can't wait to do it again.
Yes, this is our second podcast. So those of you who are super fans, go back and find the first one. Some things have happened in the year of anti-aging. I want to kind of break this down for people who are new to the whole longevity space to talk about sort of principles of aging and how you in your head and in your book also classified, like, what are the hallmarks of aging in terms of your thinking? How does that differ from the other hallmarks people are talking about? So maybe we could dive right in.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you said you wanted to start with hallmarks, right?
Yeah.
So hallmarks are generally sort of a mishmash list of things that people put together that do in fact change with age. And there's a bit of a cellular push, but it's not exactly organized. And I think that different things can be sort of slid around. So what I did starting about 10 years ago is I developed what I call the seven tenets of aging. And it is cell biology as determined by seven different categories. Mm-hmm. And very briefly, because I know this could be like, you know,
a whole conference,
right? But briefly, so tenet one is things that go awry in your DNA. And this is, of course, is telomere issues, it's epigenetic modification. And then the newest thing that I've added into this is chromatin rearrangement. So there's a sort of a push to understand heterochromatin versus euchromatin and what we can do to sort of maintain the appropriate ratios as we age. But that's tenet one. Tenet two is, of course, mitochondrial failure. You need energy to sort of power your cells. Mitochondria do a variety of other things as well, but we know that mitochondria age for seven very specific reasons, and we can focus on those. Tenet three is pathways. We talk about the seven mammalian sirtuins, which are histone deacetylases that control pretty much all cellular homeostasis. Also in this category is AMP kinase, the mTORs, and then recently I put circadian rhythms in there because I truly believe that that is an extremely important mechanism that people have overlooked for a very long period of time. So now that is part of that. Tenet four is going to be quality control. This is DNA repair mechanisms. This is protein repair mechanisms, the idea of like upregulating shock proteins and chaperones, that sort of thing, as well as autophagy, because it's very important to recycle cellular bits and pieces. And that's sort of associated with longevity. Category five is your immune system that becomes your inflammatory system over the course of time. And that obviously is a huge sort of deal in cardiovascular disease, neurologic disease, that sort of thing. Tenet six is individual cell requirements. And this is the idea that you need to protect your stem cells, eradicate your senescent cells, and then, you know, understanding that a brain cell is different than a red cell, sort of, et cetera. That's that category. Last category is waste management. This is a lot of glycation issues. Glucose and producing sugars sort of wreak havoc around the body. They destroy tissues, they destroy proteins, and they're incredibly inflammatory. So in a nutshell, that's why you age.
So you've broken it down quite differently from the hallmarks of aging, which we've also seen written about. And I really like the structure and thinking of that. It allows you to kind of expand as we learn more and more about each of those sections. Do you have like one or two of those tenets that you think are the priority?
That's an excellent question. And I think it depends on how old you are, and it depends on what your concomitant medical problems are. So I think that they're probably roughly equivalent if you get to your 50s. But in your 40s, let's just say, that's when your NAD levels start to decline. That is when your sirtuins start to decline. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's just sort of this ramp up. By the time you get to 50s, I think flat on, they're all important. But the caveat, of course, being if you're diabetic, waste management is important because that's glucose. Autoimmune things are important. That's tenet five, at some point. So depending on who you are and where you are in life, they're going to have different rates of being important.
You also have in your book kind of a list of the key supplements or things that can maybe drive or improve each of these areas and tenets. I know you take a lot of supplements. How many supplements are you taking these days? It's always like impressive amount.
So you know what's really, it sounds amazing, but compared to a lot of the longevity folks, I'm actually not as bad. So I take 60 supplements a day, but what sort of sets me apart from other folks is I take 12 pharmaceuticals.
Wow. Okay, let's start there. What are those 12 and why?
So I'll hit the big ones because So for as an example, I take something called pioglitazone, right? Pioglitazone is a drug. It's an old drug, and it's used as a hypoglycemic agent. Mm-hmm. It's not that great, so people sort of stopped using it. But what it is a PCG1 alpha activator, and that's one of the master regulators of your mitochondria. What it also does, which is really cool, is it moves your visceral fat to your subcutaneous tissues. Wow. As we get older, you look very skeletal if you're very thin, and we want to maintain the youthful idea of sort of subcutaneous fat. So in terms of like at least the appearance of youthfulness, pioglitazone I have found to be very, very useful. So that's
is that a new thing? Because your skin does look extra padded and lovely this year, like more dermal thickness.
You know, I think so. Yes, I've started pioglitazone. There's 12 of them. But the other thing that I have really started doing in the last year is I do now my own sub-Q exosome injections. Mm-hmm. And I do it, you know, every month. And I think it's really sort of starting to pay off just in terms of the healthiness of the underlying tissue.
Interesting. So controversial, because I just did a panel at the American Academy of Facial Plastic Surgery on exosomes and all the potential dangers, because you really have to be careful with the sourcing, the sterility, the quality, the manufacturing, so many different issues. But clearly you found something that's helping you and it's working. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm back to the rest of the list. What are the other top pharmaceutical ones?
So lithium, lot of longevity people like low dose or micro dosing of lithium. And in longevity world, they say between 2 to 10 milligrams. But in reality, and this is where being a physician actually kind of pays off. If you look at people with bipolar disease, they tend to have very short telomeres as compared to the normal population. If you look at people that have been on lithium with bipolar disease for greater than 2 years, statistically, their telomeres are longer, right? And no one's ever taken that much lithium without having bipolar to know if it actually works for real people. But we do know that anyone that's on lithium, you reduce all-cause morbidity and mortality. So I decided, well, what is a reasonable lithium dose? And it turns out that the regular starting dose for someone with an actual neurologic issue is 300 milligrams. So I decided a quarter of that would be appropriate for longevity. So I take 75 milligrams of lithium. It's, you know, hospital grade or pharmaceutical grade lithium, not on from Amazon, daily. I'm waiting out my 2 years to see if it's going to be efficacious in terms of telomere length.
Wow, amazing. I'm sure that a lot of people are not doing this, but are you experimenting on yourself, basically?
Of course I am.
Have you felt like it's given you some mood stability? I wonder if this might be something that we do for perimenopausal women who get cranky and angry, and maybe it not only improves longevity, but mood and stability as well.
Oh, I can guarantee you that it helps with mood stability. Absolutely. I know a lot of my friends, a lot of us are physicians, and we just sort of started doing it for longevity purposes. And it's incredibly mood stabilizing, and the dose is quite low. So the side effect is, you know, they're very low. People don't tend to see side effects until you hit the 600 to 900 milligram per day dose. And this is significantly lower than that. So it's not really a bad idea.
All right. So now we have lithium, and then what's next? Let's do like at least the top five pharmacology drugs.
All right. So we're going to skip
metformin.
We're going to skip that one because everyone knows about that one. That one's easy. But here's a fun one.
Well, at least tell us your dose of metformin.
I take 500 a day.
Okay.
The reason I do that is there was a study that came out several years ago that demonstrated if you take 500 a day in conjunction with 500 of berberine a day, but separated by 8 hours, you do better than either one independently at the higher dose.
Okay.
So I thought, okay, that's doable, right?
Yeah, that's easy. Very doable.
Other fun ones. I take something called apilvrostat.
Never heard of it.
Apilvrostat is an aldose reductase inhibitor. So the question is, like, why the hell do you need that? Glucose goes into cells, especially nerve cells in diabetics, and it turns into sorbitol. And that's incredibly osmotically active. So fluid follows the sorbitolin and it kills nerve cells. Hmm. And that's one of the reasons why you get diabetic neuropathy. But in addition, the sorbitol then turns into fructose. And fructose is 10 times more glycosylating than glucose. So you don't want sorbitol, nor do you want fructose. As bad as glucose is, it's better than the alternative. right? Mm-hmm. So the enzyme that turns glucose into sorbitol is called aldose reductase. So mm-hmm. I take an aldose reductase inhibitor, thus blocking that conversion. And I will tell you that a friend of mine's on it and his vision from cataracts has gotten significantly better. I don't have diabetes, but I think I have this theory that everyone is diabetic over time because the damage from glucose just builds up. So the idea is to avoid diabetic potential diabetic damage prospectively.
So it's like blocking your glycolation process, you know, the process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. Wow. Okay.
So here's another fun glucose one. You're going to love this one. So there's a family of drugs called flozins, and they block the reabsorption of glucose in your kidneys. Right, they're GLP-1s and 2s, but people aren't going to know what those are. But so I call them the flozin family.
Okay.
And the way this works is that your kidneys filter out fluid and a ton of glucose. It usually filters out about 90% of the glucose, just sort of floating around, that causing problems. So the kidney filters it out, but then you reabsorb the glucose back into your vasculature, right? Mm-hmm. But what these medications do is they block the reabsorption. So in effect, you're just absorbing, or you're sort of filtering it out. And with this drug, you're just peeing it out. So essentially you're dumping out any extra glucose that your just body decided it didn't need. Uh-huh. And that's just a fantastic thing to do. So lots of ways to sort of, you know, control glucose, which is one of the reasons that, you know, we don't do so well over time.
Are you still into intermittent fasting? Are you still doing any time restricted eating? Or is that not a good way to control glucose?
You're going to laugh. It turns out I am terrible at that. I tried and I tried. I am a grumpy human being. I can't do it. I just can't do it. So for people that can, you know, kudos. It's wonderful. It activates AMP kinase. It activates autophagy. It is wonderful. Mm-hmm. I just can't do it. So I go with pharmaceuticals.
Yeah. Yeah. And you like a little bit of junk food, if I remember correctly. Like,
oh, your memory's good. I do. I do. I do like junk food.
Me too. It's hard. We were raised on the sugar generation. Are you focusing on increased protein? I also have, with patients losing weight on semaglutides, I feel like we have a whole new focus on increased protein for everyone's diet.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yes.
And then any specific amount or type of protein or guidelines?
I think absolute baseline, people need their branched chain amino acids because that's what sort of drives protein or muscle development, right? Leucine, isoleucine, and valine.
Okay.
No, leucine, isoleucine, and valine. So if, for example, I'll throw in some arginine, helps with a variety of things. It's a glucose absorber, which is kind of nice. It also theoretically can help with some nitric oxide production, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a few that I think are quite important, but in general, and especially for people that are just sort of losing weight from this whole system, they're going to basically break down their own muscle looking for calories. So you're absolutely right. They need to protein load so that doesn't happen because sarcopenia is going to be a huge problem in a few years.
What are your thoughts on the whole class of semaglutides and their potential kind of longevity anti-aging benefits? Because there is some new research that's starting to show maybe it is the strict glucose control or the loss of visceral fat that improves you, but have you heard anything good about that?
So I think everyone comes at it from a different perspective. Clearly, losing fat is a good idea. Fat releases inflammatory cytokines that help with that, you know, sort of like drive aging to a certain degree. It's hard on your cardiovascular system to get fat, you know, to get blood and such to all of these heavy fat tissues. So it's just really terrible for you. So no doubt that being, you know, less sort of weighed down with all this is going to be beneficial, right? And especially by reducing the inflammatory factors that are released, you're going to have less cardiovascular disease and less neurovascular disease by definition. It's going to be helpful. But for a thin person with none of those issues, taking it, I don't think is going to be all that sexually beneficial. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be very patient dependent.
One of my big worries for the future, not only sarcopenia, but also osteopenia or bone density changes. Are there some supplements that you're on other than just like exercise, weight bearing, jumping? Like what else can we do that can bolster these bones of ours?
Oh gosh, many things. So just for your listeners that don't know, bone is very, very, very active. And the cells that break down bone are called osteoclasts. And the cells that make bone are osteoblasts. I remember in med school thinking, oh, that's kind of good. B for blasts. Got it. Build for blasts. Got it. And it turns out that the inflammasome that we develop over the course of aging, inflammatory issues activate your osteoclasts. So the more inflamed you are, the more you're going to destroy your bone. Right. And that's the other side of the equation. We can actually take things that increase osteoblastic activity. And one of my favorite ones is called naringenin, and it actually comes from orange peel, and it's extremely beneficial for maintaining or growing bone back.
Interesting. And that's a supplement. And what dose is that?
That is an excellent question. My brain wants to say 200 milligrams, but I haven't thought about it in a while. So the answer is it's in the back of my book or it's on my website.
Okay, we diverted off the pharma topic, but I want to go back to pharmacology. I know you're doing metformin. How about rapamycin?
So I am not a big believer in rapamycin. So rapamycin is an absolute mTOR agent, right? It's going to block all turnover of fast turnover cells. So it's going to make you sarcopenic. It's going to block the turnover in your intestines. It's going to block hippocampal turnover. Other tissues that need to be blocked, it's very good for. I'm just extremely, extremely concerned that over the course of time, we're going to take too much or the timing's not going to be quite right. And we'll end up with hippocampal damage, which essentially is destroying your short-term memory, which I am not ready to go down that road. But the good news is that AMP kinase and mTOR live in opposition. They sense your nutrient state, and when one turns on, the other turns off, right? So if you actually activate your AMP kinase, by default, you're turning off your mTOR pathway.
So that's the fasting is beneficial for that.
Right, so that's how you can turn it off in a controlled fashion without like the big giant gun of rapamycin. But again, that's for me. Like I'm in my mid 50s. Maybe by the time I get to my 70s, 80s, 90s, I'll be like, oh, okay, now I'm going to do it. But I think the risk is too high right now. So I personally am not willing to do it. I know a lot of people do, and I support that. But I also know that there are subtypes of the mTOR receptor. And until we have sort of definitive rapalogs that are more specific, I think it's sort of a dangerous game to play.
Everyone's experimenting on themselves in this industry and the longevity side and the peptides and health and wellness. Any other top pharma drugs before we dive into peptides?
Ooh, here's a fun one that no one's heard of. See, I love this stuff. So there's a Japanese drug. It is approved by the Japanese FDA. It's very old, 20 years old. It's called Celbex. S-E-L-B-E-X, because everyone always says Celebrex. And I go, no, Celbex. And it is actually a heat shock protein upregulator. So what's interesting is it is FDA approved for gastritis secondary to the destruction of your mucosal lining from other drugs. It increases the ability of your gut to deal with stress by upregulating your heat shock proteins, but it also means that it's going to upregulate your heat shock proteins pretty much everywhere. And so in terms of misfolding diseases, such like most neurologic diseases are protein misfolding issues. I mean, it's not the entire sort of deal, but that's one of the components of it. So therefore you can reduce relative risk of neurologic disease by taking Celbex, which then actually helps your stomach from all the other crazy drugs that you can take. So I love that one. It's sort of just like this fun thing that just throw it in.
Wow. Have you felt some differences with that? Like what would you expect to feel?
I don't think you're going to feel anything. I think it's one of those things that you just have to sort of take for granted. I know that it's helpful. And the other thing it does is because it's upregulating your heat shock proteins for those people who love to sit in saunas, you know, for an hour a day or whatever the formula is, right?
Yeah.
To upregulate heat. This is just an easier way of doing it, especially if you're traveling or you're busy or you just don't like sitting in like really hot places.
Yeah.
So you just sort of have to take it for granted that that's what it's doing.
By understanding the cellular mechanism of that. Yeah. It's a little weird to me that heat and sauna are great for you. I know the vasodilatory effect is good, but you would just imagine that heat degrades proteins and molecules and breaks things down faster. Like, aren't we speeding up all the enzyme reactions and the cell divisions and the limited number of telomeres and the collagen definitely heating that up and breaking that down faster? So to me, it's a little puzzling that it should have so many good benefits with heat.
Well, so what's funny is you are correct, but the body already knows this, right? So by being in a place where your enzymes are warm enough that they're not going to work very well, your body said, aha, I will protect them, right? So by a little bit of hemodynamic stress, right, your body upregulates the heat shock proteins that act as protein chaperones that help refold all of the proteins that you would theoretically destroy by having excessive heat.
Okay.
Right. So by the sauna thing, it's only a short period of time, but whatever temperature they always say, and I don't know because I don't do it. But the idea is a little bit of, you know, stress, hormesis to then upregulate the repair system. And my thought is, well, just take a pill for that because we have it.
Simplify your life a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I worry a little bit about, okay, I fall asleep with a heating pad. Is that good or bad? Who knows? I am a huge fan of peptides at the moment, and I'm wondering if you have started to dive into using any peptides for yourself, injectable, oral, or otherwise.
Excellent question. So in my sort of world, I think that peptides are tier two, right? Yeah. So older patients come to you and they want to immediately do peptides. And the problem is that what a peptide is, and I know you know this, but I'm just sort of reiterating for your listeners, is the peptide is a message that goes to your cell and specifically to your DNA that says, make this specific protein, whatever it is, you know, a muscle thing or a growth hormone, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But it's a very specific aimed target. So if you give that to an old person, the cells don't work very well as it is. So the response is not going to be all that great. If you give a peptide to a younger person, they're going to have a great response because their cells are functioning. So what I generally do, so when people come to me, is I will spend 6-9 months, depending on how old they are, maybe even a year, optimizing their cellular function, right? Making the factory work. Mm-hmm. And then we sort of look around and we go, okay, are all of the proteins that we need to make, are they being made? If they are, you don't need peptides. But sometimes you go, well, you know what? I could just usually, maybe I want a little bit more of this. Maybe I want a little bit more muscle development, or maybe I want a little bit more brain power. And then I use them as targeted therapies for specific goals for short periods of time.
The timing, I think, and the dosing seems to be the most puzzling to me. I guess if you're a clinician and been doing it for a long time, you have a clinical sense of it. But since nothing's really published or studied, it's challenging. Like I was asking a peptide manufacturer, like, does this depend on body weight? You're giving the same dose to everyone. If even they're a 6-foot tall obese man and a small, tiny woman gets the same dose. So how are you dosing your peptides? Do you have a protocol?
So the answer is it written down anywhere? No. But as a pediatric anesthesiologist, which is my real job, right? Everything that we do is done by weight.
Yes, right? Exactly.
Right. So if you're a 2-kilo baby versus a 70-kilo teenager, there's a wide range. Of course, they're not going to get the same dose, right? You want to talk about bioavailability and absorption. So if someone's like, you know, 70 kilos, but most of them are just like, you know, round and kind of chunky, you're going to have a different dose than that someone's like lean and muscular, but the same weight. So you take a baseline dose of whatever it is, right? And then you look at them and you go, well, you're X number of kilos, but your body composition is such. And then you sort of titrate it accordingly. Mm-hmm. And that's just sort of experience and, you know, time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think, one of the most difficult things. So one thing I love about your protocols is that you really have dived deep into the science of each substance and kind of looked at beneficial. First of all, is it harmful? Secondly, is it, you know, based on human studies? Is the research and evidence real or not real? What can the consumer do? I know they got to get your book. You guys have to read this book. But in general, like, people don't read in America. So what should the average consumer do? Like, they're just really like flying blind when they go to these health food stores or these sometimes medi spas or places that are doing random non-protocol, non-research stuff.
That is the best question ever. And I wish I had a good answer for you because I find it very funny. You know, I am who I am and I know what I know, but no one really knows who I am. I try to keep a very low profile. I don't have a clinic. I serve very concierge type patients. So I will walk into a health food store. Let's say I forgot to order my astaxanthin or something, right? And I go and just, you know, an extra bottle, right? And oh my gosh, the information that people spew at you, they don't know what they're talking about. They put on the old, I know what I'm talking about look, but when you listen to the words, oh my God, it's just flipping scary. And I am quite fearful of the poor folks that walk in trying to find something, the idiocy is crazy. Or I'll go to a spa, you know, I just want a facial, something simple. And some woman is poking my zits, you know, lecturing me on what I should do for my skin or what supplements I should take. And I generally try to keep my mouth shut, but ultimately I can't. If you didn't know these things, how would you know? You absolutely wouldn't. And I guess the answer is listen to podcasts like this. Clearly, you always have very good educated folks on and great information, but it does take a lot of time to weed through all of this stuff.
I mean, I'm diving into this research and learning for myself first in order to teach patients, but there's so much reading you have to do. I literally feel like I'm back in med school. I read like an extra 2 or 3 hours a day of all these articles to keep up with. It's quite hard for a practitioner, as like I want to be a consumer and use and buy these products and also want to give it to patients, but it's the wild, wild west out there. Crazy.
No, it is. And in fact, I'm going to London in a few weeks to give a lecture on NAD use, right?
Okay, good. Because I want to talk about that.
And you would think that that would be a straightforward NMN versus NR. And it turns out, oh my God, not at all. It has to do with which tissues prefer which one, how you metabolize them, what your microbiome looks like. And then
which conference is that?
Oh, it's just an NAD lecture at a hotel for a concierge folk thing. It's quite private, so it's not going to be advertised anywhere, but they're flying a bunch of us from the world in to have this discussion. And it turns out that it's significantly challenging, right? You want to downregulate CD38, you want to upregulate some other things, you need to block this enzyme, but turn the other enzyme on and off and da 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 da. Mm-hmm. And then I don't think it's a simple NR versus NMN. I think it's a combination because some cells prefer one, some cells prefer the other. A lot of it gets eaten up by your microbiome. Therefore, I think that an IM of straight NAD is not necessarily a bad idea as well to sort of add to the mix. So I think this is going to be a huge sort of multifaceted, how do we attack the NAD problem? And it's not as simple as like Sinclair or someone's going to tell you.
Well, for our listeners who don't know anything about NAD and ATP and how those levels drop, can you give a little synopsis of why do we care about NAD and what's the rage right now?
Sure. So the way I simplify it, right? So NAD is nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And it's sort of like an energy messenger. And it does, let's say, four essential things in your cells. So number one, it's part of the electron transport chain. It's part of the Krebs cycle and it's part of glycolysis. So it lives in your mitochondria and it helps with energy production. So when you become NAD deficient, energy sort of like falls. Secondly, you use it as a sirtuin co-activator. So sirtuins are histone deacetylases. And these are like the on-off switches that control most of your cellular homeostasis. So without NAD, your sirtuins don't work, so you lose cellular homeostasis. So that's kind of huge. Thirdly, your cells use it to help put your DNA back together. So if you have a big glob of damage, double-stranded or single-stranded, your body activates these things called PARPs, and it uses NAD to put your DNA back together. So if you're NAD deficient, you're going to have more DNA damage. And then lastly, it's used sort of as a big messenger, both within the cell and externally, to control all of body homeostasis. So problem, however, is that as you get older, you have less and less NAD. And that is for several reasons. Number one, the enzymes that make it start to decline. Two is you have more DNA damage, so the PARPs are using more of it. And then thirdly, there is a receptor that sits on your cell wall called CD38. And this uses up a ton of NAD. So as you get older, the amount that you have goes down, the requirement goes up. And then so all these systems that I talked about just don't do well. So the question for us, what do we do to make those levels rise? And there's a raging war. Do you just take it orally? Which one do you take? When do you take it? Are there other ways of sort of skinning the cat? And it turns out, I think it's going to be a multifaceted attack to deal with all of these issues.
So in general, NAD orally, IM, IV, any preference?
So I don't like the IV. I think it's too much at one time. But you have to understand that NAD is a circadian molecule. So a normal person has a specific level. It peaks about 3 to 4 in the afternoon, and then it comes back down. So if you are repleting your NAD levels, you have to sort of do the same thing that your body would do normally. So if you're going to take oral supplement or an IM supplement, then you want to do it roughly mid-afternoon. There are absolute IM injections or sub-Q injections of NAD, which are great. Orally, NAD doesn't work as well. So you need to take one of the precursors. That's NMN or NR. They're both quite good bioavailability. However, different cells prefer different ones. And I will tell you, I was a huge believer in NMN alone, but within the last 6 months or so, I've decided that that's not the right thing to do. I think I'm going to take all three of them together.
Wow. That's how your body has all three forms circulating all the time, right?
No, it does. But as an example, if you have any nerve damage, right? Let's just say you whacked your finger or something, you have nerve damage. Mm-hmm. If you have higher levels of NMN, that's actually very toxic and it promotes axonal degeneration. So that's bad. I could list 1,000 examples. Certain tissues like the other, as well, you need extracellular levels of just straight up NAD. So I think it's going to be a combination of those things in reality.
Yeah. Periodically IV, IM, oral, NMN.
Not IV. Not IV. IM, sub-Q, and oral. I think that's what it's
going to be. Some people really, you know, get a boost and a feeling of euphoria and wellness from the IV. So just to play
I know they do. They feel good.
Yes.
Because it's like, whoa! But from a longevity point of view, it's not really going to be helpful.
It's impractical and expensive and also may be very transient, of course. How about one NMA or some of the enzymes that you can treat that prevent the depletion of NAD or too much?
So one of the cool things you can do is one of the big NAD aces is this thing called CD38. It's a molecule that sits on the cell surface. And it breaks up NAD and it turns it into NAM and it does a variety of things, but it gets activated by inflammation and then it causes more inflammation. So it's just a bad player to start with. So one of the things we can do is actually block CD38 to a certain degree. They are working on real drugs to do this, but in the meantime, the most active thing that we can do or the most useful thing we can do that's over the counter is apigenin. So that's a good thing to add to our pile. That's number one. The other thing is, as you have all of these precursors floating around in your body, you're absolutely right. They sort of suck up methyl groups. So when you go to methylate your DNA, you tend to be a little bit shy. There's something called trimethylglycine or betaine that actually can then replete that. So there's a variety of things. There's also another enzyme that gets downregulated over time that converts NMN to NAD. But you can upregulate that one with ECGC from green tea.
Yeah, okay.
So there's a whole sort of slew or family of things that you can do. And I think that's going to be the answer. And no one wants that answer, right? Everyone wants a single solitary answer. But there isn't. It's going to be sort of like this complex set. And maybe at some point, and I'm sure someone will put all of these things into one supplement and then you go, ta-da, and then we're all set to go. But for the moment, that doesn't exist.
And this kind of presupposes the concept that NAD is like the central cause of the problem of aging or the ATP cycle losing efficiency. Is that the chicken or the egg? Or like, is that the thing that sets up the whole aging cycle? That you don't have enough ATP, you're not repairing DNA and fast enough, the damage is accumulating.
I would say it is a huge component of aging, but it's not the only component.
Yeah, because I think if I can't take 150 compounds a day and I have to focus on like the top 10, I would really need to think in my own head, what's the exact actual mechanism of aging that's most dramatically taking us off the path of a 20-year-old?
It is the best place to start. So when I put together my primary protocol, which I call the panacea, you know, 5 top things for the easiest way to start doing this for people that don't know where to start. The P is pterostilbene, A is astaxanthin, and the N, of course, is some sort of NAD precursor because you're spot on. It's extraordinarily important.
And what's the rest of the panacea?
So the spelling part falls apart at this point, but there's 2 C's, right? So there's curcumin, which is an anti-inflammatory, as long as it's bioavailable. Uh-huh. And then the second C is carnosine because it's a transglycosylating agent.
Oh, okay. And then the EA? Or is there
so
no
there's one? Just there's actually just an E. I throw in ECGC, which is the active ingredient in green tea. There's no A.
Okay.
There was going to be, and then people are like, you know what? We can only take 5 things. Stop there. And I'm like, okay, great.
Yeah, the average human 5 things is good. But the good thing is like 3 of those things are dietary, right?
So there's something called the Mackay berry that has delphinidin, and that's sort of in fruits and berries.
Astaxanthin is the pink salmon. That's right.
Yes. And the problem with all of this is, yes, it's good for you, but there isn't enough in anyone given food to help you as much as we need to be helped over time.
Okay.
There's healthy living, and then there's longevity living.
Right.
Right? Healthy living is choose the salmon. Longevity is eat a lot of astaxanthin.
The first one, the Panacea Terra Still Being, where does that come from? And how is
Blueberry.
that? Oh, okay, blueberries. And how is that helpful? Just antioxidant potential?
No. So it turns out that the molecular cousin is something called resveratrol, which a lot of people have heard of. I just like Terra Still Being better because it has better bioavailability. But the big thing that it does mostly is sirtuin activation.
Okay, that's interesting. And then green tea has a dose of ECGC.
It has a lot. So the answer is if you drink a glass of green tea, it has about 40 milligrams of ECGC in it. If you take a pill, it's like 400 milligrams.
Oh, wow. And doesn't that keep you all like revved up? Like there's no
No,
caffeination
it's not
involved?
caffeine per se. No.
Okay, that
Again,
makes
I take mine in the morning, but maybe.
Talk a little bit about fatty acids and what do you think of alpha lipoic acid, DHA, or omega fish oils?
So all of the lipids are important for several reasons. Number one, you must maintain the integrity of the lipid membrane of all of your cells. And as the production of these things bites the dust over time, it's important to put back all the molecules that are going to keep that healthy. So all of the things you just listed are fantastic. And I generally don't go into those things, only in that most primary care people have already addressed that. People are already on their fish oils, their omegas. The answer is they are important. There's no downside to it. You know, they are what they are. If you don't have your membranes intact, you're sort of hosed.
On the waste management side or the cleanup of breakdown products and tissues that need cleanup, what is the best philosophy and what products are you on for that?
Oh gosh, most of the waste management is glycation issues. I have a 7-step system for blocking absorption of glucose, blocking the production of new glucose, which is gluconeogenesis.
This is why I love you. This is crazy.
All very
So good.
systemized, right? Like block AGE production in a variety of ways, transglycosylate when possible. There's like lactoferrin, which is an AGE sponge. I couldn't tell you how many agents I'm on because there are a lot of them. But as an example, to get back to the drug thing, I take hydralazine, which is a medication, as you know, for high blood pressure, but I don't have high blood pressure. But the hydrazine molecule actually loves glucose. So if you take hydralazine or if you have elevated hydralazine levels in your bloodstream and you eat glucose, the glucose sticks to the hydrazine molecule and you excrete it and it doesn't affect any of your tissues.
Amazing. I did not know that. How about low dose oral minoxidil? Are you doing anything on the outside for hair growth, skin quality? Skin quality, you're doing the exosomes.
I haven't done anything for my hair, actually. It seems to be fine. The only problem is I wear the silly OR cap and I keep getting these little breakages. But beyond that, that's more of a hat problem than a hair problem.
The low dose oral minoxidil is like very game changing. My God, I didn't realize the mechanism of that is microcirculation, and the amount of hair you can grow in a very short period of time just tells you that we're losing a lot of surface capillaries, and microcirculation matters a lot.
So I will tell you that I'm on a phosphodiesterase inhibitor for pretty much that same reason, because it increases microvasculature circulation. It changes the viscosity of the serum and it changes the flexibility of red cells so that you do, in fact, get increased vasculature in your periphery or, in fact, pretty much everywhere. The caveat to that is when I do take it, my nose gets stuffy. It's a small side effect.
Do you believe in the low dose antithrombolytic or aspirin?
So I take 60 different supplements and they all slightly affect my ability to clot. Like none of them specifically is like, oh, it does this. But I will tell you that I bleed like a demon.
Curcumin especially, but also all those fatty acids. Yes. So you don't need the aspirin, basically.
I don't. And it's really funny. I drew my own blood the other day and I put a Band-Aid on it, and I sort of forget. Moments later, I realize that there's blood like cascading down my arm. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. So I co-band, whatever. But yeah, I need an aspirin like I need a hole in the head.
How about any growth factors? There's brand new on the market platelet-derived growth factor, which if you haven't read or heard about, already FDA approved for use in joints and dental surgery, mandible surgery, but it's recombinant DNA technology, and that growth factor has like almost 300,000 times the potency of like platelet-derived growth factor that you just draw from PRP. The PRP is like very watered down. So that's been super amazing in my practice. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I'm going to go look that up. That one is new to me.
Yeah, a company called AriEssence is making that. And I don't think I'll ever go back to using PRP because of that. And exosomes as well are extremely nonspecific. We really don't know what messengers we're sending into the skin, which we're just kind of turning on everything with a machine gun approach versus very specific growth factor approach. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
I'm going to look it up and I will let you know.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think we're missing in this aging picture? Because Mother Nature does things extremely well. And I feel like we're putting together this big, amazing band-aid solutions to every little problem. Like you've really analytically thought out all the steps where this system can break down. And yet it's still going to break down. We're still going to end up with frailty. And maybe we'll be 120 or 130, but you know, we're not going to have the body, like the framework of a 30, 40-year-old. I predict. I mean, maybe you will. I don't know if I will. You probably will with your regimen. But I see all the longevity population out there. They're lecturing. And I'm sorry, they look older. They look frail. Some of them are very steroided out or growth hormone, testosterone out. But I don't see a natural picture of maintaining youthfulness. I see the frailty is still there.
I think you're right. I think this is a new science.
Yeah.
I think we're working towards figuring it out. I've been in this now for a decade, but what I knew then and what I know now is just significantly different. We will eventually get there. Will we get to the point where no one ages? Probably not. Will we slow it down significantly? And the goal is just to reduce morbidity, right? If you can make it through your life with no cancer, no diabetes, no high blood pressure, and then something happens and you're 104, fine, right? It's just feeling like garbage, watching yourself age and having no tools to deal with it. That's sort of the shame. But every day we're coming up with new stuff. And in fact, it's funny because there was a slight delay on getting on the podcast and I happened to start opening my mail and I just opened my bod stim suit.
Oh, what's that?
Well, so this is a very interesting new toy gizmo. I was at a conference and a company has developed this. I have a high muscle stim suit called a Catalyst that increases muscle building and bone density and all that kind of stuff. This is a different type of frequency, and it is supposed to cause the release of clotho and follistatin into your vasculature and be extremely good for you. Mm. I have not used it yet. Literally, it's right here. It's in the box. Haven't tried it yet, but again, every day there's new technology. So
yeah.
I think we will get there. We don't have the answers yet, but at least trying new things. The old, you know, risk benefit ratio, as long as it's not going to hurt you and there's potential to help you and maybe reduce morbidity and mortality a whiff, then the answer is why not? Right.
Yeah.
And 50 years, people are going to be watching us going, wow, they had no idea what they were talking about.
They were
primitive. And they'll be right.
Yeah.
But at least we're starting the process.
I kind of feel like the mechanical aspect of life is going to be hard to keep up with, like the joint arthritis problems, sleeping on your face and crushing the tissue, like the habitual problems. I think that's going to be harder to fix and maintain hopefully we'll have solutions to that. But have you thought about anything like that? Pollution too. I worry a lot about, we can handle breakdown in our own body, but when you add that layer of pollution and chemicals from the environment, maybe microplastics, I think is also going to be a difficult problem to combat. And I think you should put a section in your book on how do we deal with microplastics? Because literally all the pills you're taking are microplastic covered. And like, you know, everything we eat, the cheese that's enveloped in plastic, the, you know, all the packaging.
And the only thing to date that's even remotely useful is plasmapheresis. So it's certainly possible at some point, maybe once every few years, we all get plasmapheresed. And I haven't done it yet, but it's certainly on the horizon of things that we need probably to do. Is it the answer? I don't know. There's so many issues and so many questions. But again, got to start somewhere. So this is what I'm trying to do. And it's why I truly, as a physician and a researcher, spend a ton of time trying to figure out what's real, what's not real, what's beneficial, what's synergistic, what's counterintuitive, because it is a huge mishmash. It's a quagmire. And again, I still don't know. And God knows other people that haven't spent that much time don't know either. Mm-hmm. However, there are some things that are just, we know to be beneficial. Eat reasonably well, exercise, you know, the basics. And a lot of people aren't even doing that stuff. So
stop drinking the Diet Coke.
Salute. That's what I'm
Cheers.
thinking. Yeah, cheers. But
I know. I read all these articles and then here I am drinking the Diet Coke. So I don't know. You got to live a little on top of everything else.
So if you take your pills, you can drink your Diet Coke. That's the trade-off.
Okay, when are you coming out with your pill set?
Oh gosh, I know. I keep thinking that I'm going to do it and then I'm working on it and then something else happens. And the answer is, I don't know. We're in talks to do it. But at the moment, my big project is I'm working on the next book, which will be a rewrite of all of the stuff, because what we know now is not what we knew 5 years ago when the book came out. I'm trying to stay up to date and keep people informed versus just trying to crank out pills, because other people are doing that. So we'll see.
Well, you are just a powerhouse. I'm so impressed with your research. And I really think you have a passion for understanding and systematizing the approach to this, which is sorely missing in this industry. So I hope we will definitely see another book. And I'm going to invite you to come to a conference and lecture with me. I want to bring all of this longevity knowledge into the field of aesthetics and plastic surgery. What we're doing on this side with bioregenerative therapies to stimulate your own collagen to grow, to make your own fat grow, to use these platelet-derived growth factors and help people heal invisibly. It's going to be next generation stuff.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I want to learn that. Yeah, invite me.
Okay.
I want to come.
Yes, we should definitely do that. Well, you got to tell everybody where they can find you and how to buy the Kaufman Protocol. Here's the book right here. This is the first one. I have the second one on the bedside table and the third one. I'm going to get a copy, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. As soon as it's written, it's yours. So I am findable on my website. It is kaufmanprotocol.com. Books are available on Amazon. As you said, there's book one and book two. My Instagram is Kaufman Anti-Aging, and I try to put, you know, small updates on there or wherever if I'm appearing, speaking, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing to know is that I answer all of my emails. I do not have a staff. It is me, myself, and I. So people always get excited and they have a question and then they send me an email and then they're annoyed when I don't immediately answer. Yeah. And I answer everything. It just takes me some time. And then the other two things is that I have Club Exosome in Vegas. So I'm there quarterly. I will be there at A4M signing books, I believe. But we're also having a Club Exosome if someone wants to reach out and ask about that. And then I actually have started seeing patients in Hollywood, Florida it's a plastic surgery office. They've asked me to do this and I opened the doors and now I'm sort of getting flooded by accident. But that being said, I am happy to see people, happy to answer questions. Obviously, I love longevity and I'm happy to share the information.
I love that. Okay. Well, if you ever want to come out to LA, well, you come out to my office and we'll set you up here too.
Deal. That'd be great. Actually. That'd be fun.
Yeah, we should do that. We should have you come over. Well, there you have it, you guys. That's the state of the art information and a really great framework on how to think of aging, the breakdown processes of the body and how to maintain. You motivate me. I'm going to have to get on some of these more products, even though I hate swallowing pills, but I'm going to do it for you, for me and for you.
I thank you enough. And every time you're swallowing, just take a swig of Diet Coke and they go down so much easier.
They neutralize each other, right?
Do, yes.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sandra Kaufman. And check out her Instagram and her handles. You can find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, doing amazing things with people's faces. And don't forget to check out our website, beautybydrk.com. I'm going to send you again a nice little packet of our skincare.
Oh, I love your stuff. Oh, it's fantastic. I love it.
Awesome. This year we came out with collagen peptide powder, which I'll send you some of that too. Great for protein nice. And adding to your coffee and building those amazing building blocks that collagen needs. That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.